I'd like to call the committee to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but I'd like to get started just so that we don't run out of time. But members should know that if we do run out of time today, that we will be reconvening at 6 o'clock in this room. So just so members are aware. And so... So, we're going to begin by asking Emily Cleveland from House Research to just give us a few minutes of overview on this topic. We're going to be hearing House File 589, and this is a topic that can cause some confusion, and so I just asked Ms. Cleveland if she would frame the issue for us, just to let us know where we are on this issue and kind of give us an idea of why we might be hearing the bill today.
Sure.
Ms. Cleveland.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Emily Cleveland. I'm with the House Research Department. As Chair Liebling said, she asked me to provide kind of brief history of the genetic privacy law, and which is in Minnesota statute, and then also the Supreme Court case, Bearder versus State of Minnesota. So I plan to provide a brief kind of timeline of legislation and then also a summary of the Bearder decision. In 2006, the legislature enacted a provision in Chapter 13, which is the chapter that deals with data practices, data held by government. And Chapter 13, Section 13.386, which is the genetic information, privacy information law, it governs the treatment of genetic information held by government agencies. It includes a definition of genetic information, classifies genetic information as private data on individuals, and then restricts government collection, use, storage, and dissemination of genetic information unless otherwise expressly provided in law. So following enactment of the genetic privacy law, there was dispute as to whether the health department's newborn screening program, which is governed in Chapter 144, was also subject to the restrictions of this new genetic privacy law, or whether it fell under the exception phrase, which is the unless otherwise expressly provided in law. And today I'm not going to go discuss the actual newborn screening program, but there is a short subject available on the House Research website that gives some details if you're interested in the duties and authority under there. So the dispute over whether the genetic privacy law governed activities under the newborn screening program continued over a course of years, and it reached the state Supreme Court, and that case is the Bearder versus State. And the decision was issued in late 2011. In Bearder, 9 families sued the state of Minnesota, including the health department, over the department's practices under the newborn screening program, including the collection, use, storage, and dissemination of blood samples and test results without informed written consent, and they argued that it was a violation of the new privacy or the genetic privacy law. In November of 2011, the state Supreme Court issued its ruling in the case and found that the genetic privacy law does apply to activities under the newborn screening program, and it restricts the collection, use, storage, and dissemination of blood samples that are collected pursuant to that program. Also, they found that the newborn screening statutes do provide an express exception to the genetic privacy law, only to the extent that the health department is authorized to administer newborn screening tests, newborn screening by testing samples, recording and reporting the results, maintaining a registry for the positive cases in order for follow-up services, and storing the results as required by federal law. The case was then remanded to district court, and part of this Bearder case was part of the court's review was an interpretation of the genetic information term as defined in the genetic privacy law. They determined that it was they're determining whether or not it included the blood samples themselves, And the court found that it does. So under the case, the blood samples are genetic information for purposes of the genetic privacy law. So last year then, last session, 2012, following the Bearder decision, legislation was passed. In part, it addressed authority and duties under the newborn screening program in light of the Bearder decision. But more relevant to the bill before the committee today, there was also two provisions related. One included a public health exception in Chapter 13, or in the genetic privacy law, that allowed the health department to continue its other activities for roughly 1 year and required them then over the last year to analyze the interplay between the department's activities and the genetic privacy law and then to come to the legislature and propose any legislation to address the issues. And the product of that evaluation is the bill that you're hearing today.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cleveland. Does anybody have questions for Ms. Cleveland before we move along here? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Cleveland, for your presentation. So we have a quorum, members, and so I wonder if Representative Lohmer, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, and would you like to move them?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
All right. Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of February 19, 2013. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. I will move Representative Kahn's bill to get it before the committee. So I will move House File 589 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And Representative Kahn, that's where you're expecting it to go?
Yes.
Okay. So the bill is now before the committee. And so Representative Kahn, or
Madam Chairman, we do have an amendment in the folders, don't we?
So Representative Kahn, if you'd like to begin, and I see you have Mr. Koppel at the table, so
yes. Go ahead. Well, this is a very complicated issue, and it's particularly complicated for you, for me, because I was the one who messed it up in the first place and caused it. And as we said in 2006, Minnesota statutes was enacted to govern the treatment of genetic information held by government entities. And then there was litigation after that that challenged whether the statute governed activities conducted by the Department of Health as part of its newborn screening program. And one of the problems was that samples were being kept and genetic studies were being done on those samples. Part of the requirement is for the accreditation from the federal Department of Health, federal rules. So there was a long working out of the language in the last year for the newborn screening program under Minnesota statutes, and we all to specifically allow them. But the problem was that the Bearder court decision had gone far beyond just newborn screening. So we had to deal with every other sample that the Department of Health and other entities had. And so that's why this bill was needed. And I'd actually like to turn to the department to give a further explanation of it.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Mr. Koppel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. As was stated in the overview, the department was asked to come back this year, having gone through two things as a result of the court decision in 2011, was to look at all of the programs that we operate and analyze them in regards to the genetic privacy legislation and the impact that the court decision in November of 2011 may have in terms of how we view our programs and what steps we think are necessary to correct that. So we did a fairly thorough internal analysis of our programs. We have brought forward this legislation as a result of that, but I want to make it clear that we what preceded this legislation was a lot of internal analysis. We went through our programs, and for instance, I think the lessons or the premise that we took coming into this was that the Supreme Court made a decision that the collection, dissemination, the use of data would all have to meet either express authority, which means it has to be legislation, or consent. And as you know, we have had decades of legislation at the health department that have set up nearly 100 programs that we operate. Many of those programs have express authority, meaning they are in law. Many of them are what we call general authority, which means that we've been told to go do something, and so we go do it. And then there is also rulemaking, and we have written rules which comply with the legislation that was passed. In the Supreme Court's decision, they viewed express authority as the key piece of what was needed. And express authority meaning we need legislation. What we have brought forward today is a legislation that in general does no more, allows us to do no more than we do now. In other words, we're not expanding authority, expanding reach, but what we are doing is putting into statute many of the activities that we have general authority or through rulemaking authority, and we're putting those into statute so that we have the cover we need, and we certainly don't want to be exposed or have run that risk of being sued for not having correctly gone about running a operating a program. In general, we divided genetic information into two components, biological specimens and health data. The Minnesota Supreme Court said that a biological specimen is genetic information under a Genetic Privacy Act. While a specimen is very unique compared to data, you can't copy a specimen. You can copy data. So we put them in two different categories. The proposal gives MDH the authority to collect, use, store, and disseminate genetic information for program operations, for public health practice, and for health oversight. These will be permitted if authorized these are currently permitted in many ways through general laws, including rules. The one important thing is that the provisions in this bill do not supersede any other bill. In other words, as many of you were familiar with the newborn screening legislation that passed last year, it has its own set of standards, its own clear consent, collection, dissemination, etc. All those are addressed in that statute. And while we state in here that this does not impact that particular program, it doesn't impact any other statute either that would have its own outline statutory language would hold firm. So even if newborn screening wasn't mentioned here, it would still supersede this in statute. The research would be categorized activities other than program operations, public health service, and health oversight. And research would be done in a matter which is consistent with the federal rule for protection of human subjects, which includes de-identification and or consent. I'll stop with that. Obviously, the bill is divided into sections, and If you prefer the section-by-section overview, I'm just trying to give you a general approach that we use to address this very complex issue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Koppel. We could. There is another testifier from the Department of Health. So, right? Is Mr. Oren? No.
Yes, Mr. Oren is here and would be available for questions.
Okay.
But we generally have put forward. Think everything at this point we have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Koppel. So I think now would probably be a good time to take questions then, and we can put off the section by section unless members want us to do that. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is to Mr. Koppel. Can you just tell me specific registries that you've created to store the genetic information?
Mr. Koppel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lohmer. There are a number of them. We have them in the, we have a cancer, pediatric cancer registry. We have a birth defects registry. I don't have all of them in front of me. I can certainly give you a list of those.
Representative Lohmer? Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, as I read the briefing, you've been given a kind of a year of grace to come up with some of the language and the protocols to follow at the request of the legislature. In the 8 months that you've had to work on this legislation, it doesn't appear that you're at a state of completion, and I'm just wondering in terms of are you still working on this? And could you give me an idea in terms of where your intentions are to improve the processes that you already have in place? And I have a follow-up as well, Madam Chair.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe this is our final draft legislation. I mean, not draft, it's our final legislation.
Chairman, if I can,
Representative Kahn,
say something about that. The problem was not fixing the processes. The problem was putting the fix into law so that it would be expressly authorized instead of done by general law, which had been before, which is following the Supreme Court decision. So the problem was not any time in working out things. It was figuring out how to write. It was writing the legislation, which was pretty complicated.
Madam Representative
Chair.
Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in light of that, then, Representative Kahn and Mr. Koppel, then, what operations didn't you have express authority to, authority for, and what operations do you need it for?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have a list of all those programs and what we have specific express authority versus general authority versus rule. That was part of our analysis. When we have general authority or rule, in most cases historically, that has it's the way that many agencies do business. And in fact, almost every agency. What we feel is because of the newborn screening lawsuit and settlement and the interpretation of how genetic privacy impacts specifically one of our programs, this legislation basically puts into statute those general authority and some rules that we now use to run our programs. And so what we did was take a overall fix to what we felt was an exposure. And so it was a fairly comprehensive response.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you to the testifiers. I'm trying to catch up. I got here a little late. I apologize. Okay, I had some constituents stop by at my office. But on this issue, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the department was, or hospitals or whatever, were collecting these blood samples, okay, and they did the parents have to opt in, or could they opt out, or did they give permission? And Twyla Braze is here, and obviously she was a big part of this. And so, what was the crux of the contested issue on this lawsuit?
Representative Grunhagen, I can't see you too well over here, but this is actually not about the newborn screening program.
Oh, it is
about other programs. Representative Kahn.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, the newborn screening was taken care of with, an agreed on procedure
last
session.
Yeah, that I understand.
That's totally.
I thought this was added to it.
No, Representative Grunhagen, please go through the chair.
Okay.
And
Representative Kahn.
Okay. Madam Chairman, Representative Grunhagen. But the problem with the Supreme Court decision, and I'll have you people know, is that one of my running buddies almost every weekend is Alan Page, and I tell him just about every weekend that he was on the wrong side of that decision.
Well, now it's official.
I have this. So I have enough nerve to go to any level to defend the position I think is right. But anyway, and we have an amendment actually to totally clarify that we're not touching the newborn screening issue. The problem was that the Supreme Court went further and said it applies to all specimens, biologic specimens and samples, things which had been collected over the years and which we use for many things. So this is now leaving newborn screening alone, and we're totally clear that we're not messing with that decision that was made last year by a very solid vote, I think, and we're specifically dealing with the other biological samples.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that clarification. And so, then, in relationship to what this bill does, do people opt in or opt out in terms of giving you that information,
Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, each program runs under different rules and statutes, and so they're all set up differently. The newborn screening program, for instance, you can opt out of the newborn screen. You don't opt in, you opt out. And then if the blood spot is to be kept more than 71 days, or if the dad is to be kept more than 2 years, that requires an opt-in. On behalf of, but each program is set up differently. We, that's a one that's certainly been out in the purview of the legislature more recently. But we have many other programs that don't require that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Grunhagen,
I'm starting to focus now. It was a little blurry at first, but it's coming into focus. The concern is, and from my standpoint about this controversy, is number one, I understand the need for research, okay, and for coming up with information that can help cure diseases in the future, and I'm supportive of that. The concern is that the privacy issue, and obviously Representative Holberg's much more expert on that than I am, but that that information about you is being kept, whether by the healthcare institution or the government, and that someday it might be used to determine whether the type of healthcare that you get. Now, whether that's real or imagined, that seems to be some of the strong concern that one day it'll be used by unelected people to make decisions about your healthcare, and to what degree that has any validity, I'm not quite sure. I do have a lot of concerns about government encroachment on the healthcare industry and the negative effects it's having. So just want to make that comment.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And just before I go on, I know you weren't here, Representative Grunhagen, but this bill is going to the Committee on Civil Law. And so today we're really not discussing the data practices aspect of this bill. That will be discussed in civil law. Okay. So we're really here today as this is the Health Committee. This is very much about health. And so I do have a couple of other members on the list. But before we go on to them, Mr. Koppel, I wonder if this would be a good moment for you to give us some examples of the things that the Department of Health does, because we do want to know this is about health, and a lot of these programs are about health. And I wonder if you could just help orient us by giving us just a few examples of what those things are.
Madam Chair and members, I will give a broad view of some of the programs we do, some of the things and activities that we do. We do restaurant inspections. We follow up if there is a foodborne outbreak, if somebody gets sick at a restaurant, we're the ones that follow up, come in and find out who ate there, you know, what the food was. If it was an oyster bed off the coast of Hawaii, we know it's tagged. We know that those groups of oysters are unsafe. We know what restaurants those are at. We go to those restaurants. We find out the list of who ate those oysters. If they paid by credit card, we can actually help find people who are going to be suffering some maladies from that. So I'm giving you that detail to know, to show you the what I might categorize as health protection activities that we're engaged in. When there's the recent flu outbreak, we are, you know, following every case reported. We are looking at outbreaks in nursing home facilities. We're looking at outbreaks in schools. We're keeping track of all of those. We keep track of the number of hospitalizations, number of deaths. When there is, I actually have a got handed me today, and it's a very interesting thing, and it has to do with the idea that it isn't just outbreak by outbreak that we look at things. When something happens, when someone gets salmonella poisoning from something, it doesn't necessarily mean it's all the same. You could trace it back to the exact same thing, and this is what I'm going to read you, just a brief kind of a living history here of what we do. And I am not, do not have a medical background, so some of these things I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce a couple of words, but I'm, because they're not relevant to the story. On February 11th, the department interviewed a routine case of salmonella, and it goes on to give it a long listed name. This pattern has not been seen in Minnesota since 1997. Our lab did a 120-day national search for the Center for Disease Control designated pattern and found 8 matching cases in 7 states with isolation dates ranging from November 30th to January 27th. Of interest, this is the same pattern that was associated with a multi-state almond outbreak in 2004. We're following up with other states with matching cases to determine if there are any shared exposures. My point being, do you see how complicated these things are, that we have to have the data, we have to have that history to know where that outbreak came from, when it last appeared, what that looked like. We keep those specimens, and they're not pretty. And we have that data so that we can always be prepared and respond to those outbreaks. We have a premier health department in the country that does that. Those issues of health protection that I just outlined are not all, you haven't given us, I have a list here of reportable diseases to the Minnesota Department of Health. You know, there's a long, long list. Those aren't, with the exception of tuberculosis, many of those aren't in statute. You know, we're given the authority to say, hey, if you hear of something bad, go out and investigate it, find out what it is, respond, whether there's immunizations, whether there's follow-up treatments, take care of it. That is not in statute, and those are some of the activities that we undertake and that are taken care of in this legislation through broad express authority that is in this legislation. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel, Representative Kahn.
Interject the personal story. Again, I had come back from, actually many years ago, a legal trip, I'll point out, a trip to Cuba, and had come back and got drastically sick. I guess, on my way back and so forth. So I went to my doctor who took a sample, gave me the highly strong antibiotic, which worked really well, and I went home. Before I got a call from my doc, doctor's practice about what it was, I had a call from the health department who wanted to know exactly what the history of that sample was. They totally lost interest when they heard it was from a farm in Cuba and not a church supper in Bemidji or something like that. So they just, but they got to me way before my, you know, 2 days, I think, before my doctor did in terms of how fast their reporting system worked.
Thank you. I have Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, Representative Kahn, you talked about it. This is not about the baby DNA. So I guess I'm still trying to get my head around what exactly, what types of biological materials do you have, and then where are they kept?
Okay. Well, Representative Kahn.
I just want to point out, and I'll let them give the specifics, but this bill allows the Minnesota Department of Health to do what it has done for years, nothing more and nothing less. And so that's just the, and because of the court decision, they're very good medical practices that are carried on throughout the country, if not the world, were put in doubt. So let me turn over to them for more specifics.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Lohmer, the newborn screening program is a unique program in that every baby, unless you opt out, is screened, and you know we keep those blood spots for 71 days and the data for 2 years. Beyond that, you know, we have a reporting system where we know about, we have data. We don't necessarily have the genetic, the DNA, but we have data, which is under the genetic privacy to be treated like it's considered genetic information. But the various registries that we have would have some information on them, depending if they're cancer registries, for instance. And so I don't believe there's, you know, these are programs that we've operated for, in some cases, decades, and there isn't anything new in this legislation that's going to give us the authority to do, collect one more thing or hold one more thing any longer than we do right now. In fact, there's a couple places in this legislation where we actually have provided more protection than less. So I'm not going to be able to answer you. I'd have to have someone come up from our lab of all the different kinds of things that we get in. Most of it is around the health protection activities that we do. But we do get a lot of material, specimens, you know, certainly around diseases, other ways too. And so we do have that. And we do store that for use in the future. And we do also, where we interact with the broader health community, is we give guidance. We don't tell doctors what to do or not to do. That's a medical care. We're not into the medical care system. But we may do find through our work with response to diseases that there is a certain practice that works very well that we will then pass on to the medical community, like a vaccination, whatever it might be, and then those practices become standardized in the medical community. But we certainly don't practice medicine as a rule, and we're much more concerned with the broad public health.
Representative Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, thank you for that answer. I guess I'm just looking at subdivision 3 here also, and just curious, it says on line 3.27, unless required under other applicable law, consent of an individual is not required. So I'm just curious and wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, let me just find that in the...
Here, it's right in the front.
Subdivision 3 on bottom of page 3, line 3.27 and 3.28.
Mr. Copple.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Lomer. Your question is, for instance, here, what is covered there? Or what does that mean? It means that, like, for instance, in newborn screening, there are specifics about what is required for consent and when. There are some programs where, for instance, on reportable diseases, consent is not needed. And so where we don't have it specifically in statute in these other areas, it's not needed. And that's basically what that's stating.
And that's new.
Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is...
No. Well, it is existing practice right now. None of these... I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Lomer, right? These are all existing programs that have run this way, are run this way. There are no changes that we're making in this legislation.
Finish? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just because I think what gets a little confusing is sometimes when we see bills in front of us with underlined language, we see that as new statute. And this is, in fact, new statute, but it's only putting into statute what you have already been doing, and it clarifies what the commissioner can and cannot do. I think that's maybe where we're getting a little confused and muddy. Is that correct?
Mr. Copple.
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, thank you. That's very correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And
thank you, Representative Mack.
Thank you. And just a couple questions. I know we're dealing with how this relates to health and bettering public health here in this state. And I guess I do wonder, is there a place, I would imagine you maybe don't have it here today, but a place where there is a list of the number of registries that the department has and what all is being collected and for what purpose? Is there, I believe there was a formal request, I believe last session, for that to be possibly provided or at least made available if members were interested. Is there a place you could point us to where that information is transparent to understand how many registries there are, what is collected in each one, and for what purpose? What's trying to be accomplished?
Mr. Copple.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I'm not familiar with it being in one place right now, but I would be happy to provide you. I think Representative Lomer had asked earlier for a similar, and I will provide that information to you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Mack.
Thank you. I think it would be helpful just in the sense that this is obviously complicated stuff and difficult to sometimes always understand the purposes behind it, but I think that would probably make your guys' job a bit easier if that information was easily attainable and able to be seen. And so the one thing I just want to make sure, too, if I understand it, this legislation is trying to ensure that you're not collecting or storing or using data of any kind or health information that you're not expressly given the right to do, correct?
Mr. Copple.
I want to make sure, Madam Chair, before I answer that question, this legislation takes what we have general authority to do now and moves it into express authority, which is statute.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up then with what Representative Mack said. So in light of, from what I understand, you were responsible for and reporting back to Representative Holberg with a list of those areas where you didn't feel you had express authority under statute, that you did secure it, and then you were supposed to provide that listing back to Representative Holberg by a certain date. Has that or is that going to be completed?
Mr. Copple.
Madam Chair and Representative, those are conversations between Representative Holberg and myself and other members of the department. That was not part of the legislation. However, we have, and I continue to have, I just met with Representative Holberg. I've met with her twice this week, and we're scheduling a meeting tomorrow. We worked very, very closely last year together to get the newborn screening legislation passed, and it has always been our intent to work very closely with Representative Holberg in this process, but it was not a specific requirement or for a deliverable. I would say to you, though, that we did provide some preliminary information. We have done a thorough analysis of that work, but we have not made it public.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, the law, the language in the law, which I have in front of me, specifically required proposed legislation. And this is the bill before you. It is true it came instead of 1:15, the introduction date was 2:14. If any one of you thinks you could have done that any faster, I'll happily hand the bill over to you. It's really not, you know, not an easy issue. So I apologize for the lateness of it. I introduced the bill. It's clearly my fault, and, you know, make apology to the committee and hand the bill over to anyone who wants it.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, certainly was not my intent, as Representative Kahn has known my brief history with her, to provide her with a gotcha moment, merely to verify that the agreement that was in place was being fulfilled in as timely a fashion as possible. So I've satisfied my question on that. I do have a follow-up, Madam Chair, if you will oblige me.
Representative Albright.
For Mr. Koppel, on page 3, and this has to do with subdivision 3, where you're de-identifying under line 3.34, de-identifying biological specimens. And this goes more to the point of the patient itself. In the disclaimer, the opt-in for recognition that their biologic specimens are going to be utilized in this fashion, is that language disseminated to the patient at the time that they're releasing their specimens? My point goes to identifying that they are releasing even a de-identified specimen to public health labs for further investigation or review.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, no, we do not have to get consent for that de-identification process. There are certain research that does require consent, and then but the de-identification process does not.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, there is an amendment, I think, which people have. We don't. Okay.
What happened?
What happened?
Sorry, Representative Kahn. We don't have that. Maybe that could be done in the Civil Law Committee.
Okay. It was suggested to us by Ms. I can have it, that we can put it out. It was suggested to us by Ms. Cleveland to make it completely clear that we weren't dealing with the newborn screening, issues. We can, you know, to what did you do?
What? She was just.
One point.
Go ahead. Representative Ward, did you want to make a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may be missing something. 1.22, 1.23, but not newborn screening activities conducted under sections. Is that what you're looking for, or is that applying to a different part of the bill?
No, that's exactly what we're doing. We're deleting these lines and making it just more explicit to completely cover newborn screening and making it explicit that we don't have to do that new rules from now on, rules that we do from now on will follow this procedure, but all of the things that were done under previous rules stay in shape. So it's, again, it's just to make it completely clear that we're not mucking around with last year's decision on newborn screening, but that we also, you know, that any new rules process goes from now on, as opposed to having to go back and do everything over again.
All right. So, Representative Kahn, I think we do not have a 24-hour rule in this committee, so we may be able to take your amendment. But what I would do is, we do have another testifier, So what I would suggest, I don't know, Representative Albright, were you done with your line of questions?
Let me just clarify. So I'll use a real world example. I go in because I find and notice a spot on my shoulder, and I think it's precancerous. And so they go in and they excise a specimen, and it comes back as being benign. It's fine. But I sign a piece of paper basically saying that I don't care. You know, if you want to look at my cells, you know, have at it, you know. But in that disclaimer, after my biological specimen has been de-identified, is it made clear to me as the patient that in that context, my cells and my skin patch is going to be extended on to whomever else wants to look at it for some dermatological study or of a nature that, you know, wants to further advance the cause in that regard? Am I told about that, even after it's de-identified, that that's going to happen?
Mr. Koppel?
I know we're getting down in the weeds. I just apologize, but I just know that when I'm, Madam Chair,
right.
Madam Chair, just from an explanation in terms of why I'm asking a question, is really more to get to the context of the see-through to the final end of the specimen itself, rather than at the door before it is released, just so that the patient appreciates just the expansiveness that specimen might take on, and if the weight of that might weigh more distinctly on the release of the information by the patient. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, in that case specific that you just brought up, we wouldn't be getting any of that information to begin with. So when you see your doctor and they may, you know, he or she may do some tests, we're not getting those test results, or, you know, it's not a, there may be another avenue for that provider who may be, you know, checking it against something else somewhere else, but that's not, we're not that.
You don't care about me, do you?
Mr. Koppel, do you care about Representative Albright?
I'm increasingly, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Albright.
So to the point that you just expressed then, does the characterization of the specimen itself distinguish your care for me if it were known to the doctor that it might be of an infectious nature versus cancerous, or it might be of, to use Representative Kahn's perspective, I go to a foreign land and I come back with something that, you know, makes me itch, mm-hmm. or makes me, you know, break out in hives or a fever. So can you objectively quantify when you care about a sample and when you don't care about a sample?
Mr. Koppel.
I'm feeling the love. I can tell you that.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm going to turn to Dave Oren to answer that question. It's beyond me.
All right. Representative Albright, you finally got Mr. Koppel to say uncle. So here we go. Okay. Mr. Oren, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Oren. I work for the Department of Health as the Chief Legal Counsel. And I can answer Representative's question at least in general terms. If it's of an infectious nature, we are interested in it if it can affect other people. In other words, when Representative Kahn talked about having the sickness coming back from Cuba, when we identified that sickness, I'm pretty sure it's one that people could not catch from her. That's why our interest changed. If it's something that people could have caught from her, then we would have been more interested in it and her contacts. In other words, if it's contagious when she's got it. And so this list of diseases has a mixture of the ones that are contagious and the ones that we'd have to trace back to, say, a foodborne source. And whichever case it is, if it's a foodborne source, we want to isolate that food and get it off the market so that people don't continue eating it. If it's something that's a continuing process, like cantaloupe a couple of years ago that was being infected at the grower's place, that was taken off the market permanently. If it's something that you can catch from the person, then that person would be isolated and their contacts would be contacted so that they could take measures to protect themselves. So it just depends on the type of threat that that germ provides. The specimen is really something that's almost always clinical materials would be an isolate of the germ. So if it's salmonella, the lab that would test your specimen would isolate the germ from that, and we would get just the germ. And we have means to look at the germ to see if it's salmonella, and we actually DNA type that salmonella to see if it's the one related to those almonds from 2004 or if it's a different salmonella, because sometimes you'll get a bunch of salmonella cases in and you get several different clear patterns. And so you know that you have several outbreaks instead of one. And so that's the type of detective work that we do, and that's the type of reason why we need samples in some cases. Now, in some cases, the lab's not able to isolate the specimen, so they'll send in the clinical material, and our lab, which is a very high-tech lab, can isolate the germ. And so, yeah.
If I might add, Madam Chair, Representative Wright, then the isolate is not identifiable. Once you create an isolate, then that's not you can't link it back to the person. Sorry, am I correct?
When you share it with another lab,
right? It is an isolate.
Yeah, Representative Albright, you want to try one more time? You have
something. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so if you're tagging and identifying the DNA for a specific cell or infectious disease, it would be kind of an ipso facto moment to surmise that you're also able to tag or to identify the DNA structure for a specific person because you're doing it at the same time.
No.
You can't tag that.
Representative Kahn.
No. If you look specifically, you get the specific things on not re-identifying it back to a person. The specific language on page 3. But when you're isolating, we specifically said when you isolate the organism that caused it, that is totally devoid of the tissue in which it was in. I was assured that they'd probably thrown out my Cuba sample if they were any. Wasn't worth keeping. So.
All right. Representative Kahn, I'm going to move your amendment so we can get that on the bill. So I'm going to move the A2 amendment and put it before the committee. And do you want to describe it?
Maybe let Ms. Cleveland. Well, the only purpose of this amendment is to make it absolutely perfectly clear that we're not mucking around with the newborn screening thing, which a lot of time went into last year.
Okay. We'll ask Ms. Cleveland to just describe the amendment before we vote on it.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and members, the A2 amendment, lines 2 through 5, replace the paragraph B on the first page, and I thought it read more clearly, and so that's what I had suggested to do. Getting at their same intent, but it reads more clearly. And then on lines 6 through 9 of the amendment, that's amending page 3, lines 17 and 18. And that is dealing with rules being adopted, and there was it's trying to express that rules adopted as of currently that are adopted now and then rules adopted in the future would be consistent with the requirements of this section in statute.
All right. Members, any questions to the amendment? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. maybe to Ms. Cleveland, on lines 1.3 and 1.5 of the amendment, it references paragraph A. I think I just found it as I was scrambling before. That's paragraph A starts up on line 1.8 of the bill and outlines, and that's what it's referring to. Am I understanding that correctly?
Ms. Cleveland.
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, yep. The paragraph A would be the existing genetic privacy law that's in statute now.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Other questions to the amendment members? All right, seeing none, let's vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the panel, what would happen if we did not pass this bill? What difference is it going to make?
Representative Kahn.
We may get to some awful dopey Supreme Court decision again. I mean, you know, someone could sue because something was being done, and the Supreme Court might make a bad decision as they did before and agree with them, and that would just, you know, cause an awful lot of legislative activity and a lot of Department of Health activity, too. It really clears up what this just says. Is what we've do. You know, we do have one of the best departments. Well, I'll let these guys. Maybe I should let these guys. But what it does is it just says that what we're doing that was thrown into doubt because the Bearder decision confused data with specimen is now fixed up for the rest. We dealt with the separate problem of newborn screening and consent and so forth that was dealt with last year. Now this takes care of all the rest of the specimens that we have to make a clear differentiation between data and specimens.
Okay. Mr. Koppel, if you could tell us some things we might not be able to continue doing, and then I'm going to go to Ms. Brace because she's been waiting to testify. Please.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Ward. What this bill does, and just to give you a quick history, is there were several years where there was an attempt to pass a newborn screening legislation which have codified, put into statute, the practices of newborn screening. If that had been done, in other words, it would be expressly allowed, there would not have been a Supreme Court decision needed because it's the law. But it wasn't law. It was, again, either rule or general authority. And so what we're trying to avoid is the idea that if someone were to question one of these practices we're doing, that we have it in express authority at this time. We were very nervous last year during this process with newborn screening, the discussion, because it kept going back to genetic privacy, because that's what it was based on. The Supreme Court decision impacted newborn screening, but was totally based on genetic privacy. We were increasingly concerned that anybody could bring another case on an ambiguity. And while there hasn't been any discussion, a nice healthy paranoia that this is taxpayer money at risk, as well as the amount of work and court time and legal proceedings that these things take up. It's not something you ever want to do or repeat. So that's what we're trying to do here, is to just manage our risk in a responsible way. Again, repeating, we are not setting up anything that allows us to do anything new that we are not currently doing in practice under rule, general authority, or current express authority. And that's the purpose for this bill today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Koppel. So I'm going to call on Ms. Braze to come down and testify, but I am going to repeat that this is going to civil law. We're not here to discuss the data practices issues. Those will be, I'm sure, given a thorough airing in the Civil Law Committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. The only thing I would say about that admonition about not talking about the data is I feel like all I've been doing this whole time is listening to the conversation about the data, and the whole bill seems to be about the data. So I will try and parse that out in whatever way that is possible. So the first thing that I would say is I think the bill is a concerning bill, and it is sweeping for what it does to our privacy and our genetic rights. I would have appreciated a section-by-section overview so the listening public could have even heard what, you know, might be in this bill. What I would like to point to is, first, about the amendment, is I think that that does a much better job of explaining what I have heard them say that they wanted done, which was to make sure that it didn't impact what happened last year with the newborn screening. And so I think it is a far improvement from the language as it originally came out. The second thing I would say is that, you know, this is interesting because their conversation is about existing practice, right? But it shows you just how much the department has done and is doing on a regular basis, just under the general authority that we don't know. And when it comes to the baby DNA, which you have been discussing, this is something that was being done in the very same way. But we happened to discover it in 2003, and then the parents sued in 2009. So, but yet still we do not have the report, and I was part of the discussion last session talking about the report that the department was going to make about all the different specimens that they collect. And what I think that you need to think about is before the bill moves forward, it would behoove everybody on this committee, everybody in the legislature, to figure out exactly what the bill does. Because if you don't know what they already collect without any legislative authority, what does this bill authorize? And by passing it, what more would it authorize? I think it's also important to look at what the language is in the bill. And so I actually went through the bill word by word, and I want to just show you some of the broad undefined terms in the bill, because what the department says is they want to get express authority. But when you look at some of the terms in the bill, you'll find out it's not so express. So, for example, on line 2.19, the word other activities, or on line 2.32, compliance with regulatory requirements. Whose regulatory requirements, I would be wondering. Or on lines 3.1 to 3.8, a list of actions related to public health practice. So what could all these actions mean that the author intends to make into state law? They include monitoring the health status of a population, conducting program evaluations, what programs, how many, making recommendations concerning health for a population. These two population ones seem to me to be very comprehensive oversight of 5.2 or whatever the current population is of Minnesota. There's also that they'll be conducting other activities without defining those other activities necessary to protect and inform and improve the health of individuals and populations for which biological specimens or health data are necessary. And I ask, well, what is necessary? Who decides what's necessary? Then you have to ask the question, what other activities using our medical records and our DNA could suddenly under this bill be legal? So keep in mind, as Representative, I think it was Albright, mentioned, on line 3.30, it says individuals have no consent rights to the government's collection, storage, use, and sharing of this information. Now, on the other hand, it says on, I don't have the actual line here, but it talks about that the health data can be disseminated only under 13.04. But that's only about the dissemination, not about the collection, the storage, or the use. So it seems to me there's some control there, but not a lot. The other interesting thing is that how it defines genetic information as compared to the genetic information part of the law. It actually defines it as biological specimens and health records, whereas in Section 1 of the bill, it doesn't show it in Section 1 of the bill, but because it's a different subdivision, I think it's Subdivision 2 of the Genetic Privacy Act, which defines genetic information differently than biological specimens and health records. And then I guess the last thing that I would say is if you look on lines 3.29 to 3.32, this allows these specimens to be used to establish a diagnosis, provide treatment, identify people at risk of illness, to conduct an epidemiological investigation of a serious disease, and I guess they get to define what serious means, and to diminish an imminent threat to the public health. And I guess they also get to define what's imminent, and they get to define what a threat is. So it's very broad. This is not express authority. It's very broad authority. And then they can use it for research, which is analysis above and beyond all analysis in lines 2.25 through 2.34, so-called program operations. So when I look at this, I say there's really essentially no limit to the analysis that can take place on individuals whose specimens and health data the commissioner has and will have under this bill. So I'm very concerned about what this will do to the rights of people in this state, the privacy rights, and what they will think when they go into their clinic or into their hospital and they're sharing information, and how the state health information network could be accessible to the commissioner for all of these purposes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Huntley, I know you'd want
well,
to
I,
get on
the I don't have a question for Ms. Brace, but I have comments.
Okay. Are there questions for Ms. Brace? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Brace. Representative Huntley.
Well, I have the list. Fortunately, it's a bigger print than the ones they held up. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to read it. There's a number of diseases that have to be reported by phone as soon as they're analyzed by a clinic or hospital. And the samples have to be sent in to the Department of Health as well. So that would normally be a blood sample, which would have the individual's DNA available in it, which we've heard they're not going to look at. And, you know, if somebody in Minnesota comes down with cholera, I would hope that the Department of Health finds out about it and gets the sample to make sure that it really is cholera. If it's measles, we had a case in the last year where somebody was in Africa, came back, and about 10 kids got measles from that particular individual. I think the Department of Health ought to know about that and be able to track the samples. Another one is SARS. I don't know if you folks remember SARS, but it was a relatively new disease. I'm not sure it was on anybody's list that we should look at, but it hit Canada and put... killed a number of people and put a whole bunch of people in the hospital. And I don't think it was on anybody's list in the United States we ought to be looking at SARS, because you don't ever know when a new one is going to come out. And the last one is that I'm going to talk about is not communicable from one person to another, but it's one of the triumphs of the Minnesota Department of Health, and that was toxic shock syndrome, which killed thousands of young women in the United States. And anybody that came down with toxic shock, their samples had to be sent to the Department of Health, including their own blood samples. And it was ultimately the Department of Health in Minnesota that figured out what was causing toxic shock, and that's not a communicable disease. If we hadn't got those samples, if somebody had sued and said, I don't want my sample sent to the Department of Health, thousands more women would have died. So I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. I think we're ready to vote, members. Seeing no other questions here. So Representative Kahn, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 589, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank
you,
Representative Kahn. Next on the list, we have House File 310. Welcome to the committee for Representative Moran, and would you like to move your bill?
Yes, and thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 310 to recommend to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Government Operations.
All right. Representative Moran moves that House File 310 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Government Operations. And Representative Moran, you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I do,
and
Madam Chair. It's an A1 amendment that I would like to move to get the bill into the shape I would like it in.
All right. So Representative Ann Moran moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to discuss it. All those in favor of the A1, I should ask, are there any questions about the A1? We'll get it on the bill, and then we can move ahead. Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So go ahead, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I really want to say first, thank you for having this bill come to your committee. I am really excited and honored to be the lead author of this bill. So this bill creates a cultural and ethnic leadership community council within the Department of Human Services. And what I would like to do is, before I turn it over to Mrs. Wilcox to explain how this bill came about, I would like to share with you a little bit why I think this council is important. I represent a really diverse community. You know, it's very diverse, from Caucasians to African Americans to Asians to Somali. And what comes along with that is the opportunity for me to make decisions about my community based on what I know and what I believe, but also creates an opportunity for me to go within those communities to hear from them so that they can help guide me on policies that best support all of the district that I represent. In the same way, I am always excited and interested when I look at different districts within the House of Representatives. You know, we have the urban communities, we have the suburban communities, we have the Iron Range, and then we have the rural community, which all have different perspectives. When we look at policies and the impact that policies will have on the districts that we represent, we bring in information to say, well, you know, if this policy is enacted, this is the impact it's going to have on the district that I represent. And as a person who's in an urban community, when I look at it, you know, my decision is like, this is a good policy. But then when I talk to my colleagues from the rural community or other community, they inform me of the impact that that the bill may have on their district. And I think this is really important because as we look at the disparities that are impacting the educational system, the healthcare system, and many of the other systems, someone is making decisions about our educational system, our healthcare system, our criminal justice system. And I am one to believe that, you know, although we have to take time to work with individuals within those systems, sometimes they commit crimes, sometimes they don't have the tools or the training or the knowledge to do the best that they need to do. But we as a body make decisions. So it's kind of like my belief that it's not always the burden of those individuals, but it's also sometimes the policies, the programs, the systems that are in place that perpetuate disparities. So for me, it's really, really important that when we begin to look at those disparities, and specifically now for the Department of Human Services, that it's really important that we look at communities of color to be a part of that conversation and a part of that decision-making process about what they believe can help their community reduce disparities. And so this is a little bit about what this council, I believe, can help do. It can be in a committee, at the table with the commissioner to bring solutions. And believe me, communities of colors have solutions around how disparities can be reduced. And so from that, I would like to, the department here, I would like to turn it over to her to describe how this came about and why it's necessary.
Ms. Wilcox, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of this committee. My name is Antonia Wilcoxon. I'm the Director of Community Relations for the Department of Human Services. This committee that currently meets is called the Disparities Reductions Advisory Committee. It is a group of representatives from the different communities of color most impacted in disparities or services that the Department of Human Services funds. And it was formed about 3.5-4 years ago as an informal committee. We held monthly meetings. And mid last year, we developed a summary of recommendations that were then directed to the Department of Human Services. 2 years ago, there was a request from this group that the Department of Human Services consider making it a more formal presence with the agency. So we introduced the bill in which you, Madam Chair, was the chief author back then, and we're very grateful for that, but it didn't move forward. So we returned with a similar bill and the creation of this, the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. And as you can see, it does have a purpose, which is to provide advice to the Commissioner of Human Services on issues of disparities and as they impact groups of populations that we serve.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wilcox. And are there questions for members? Representative Lobler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I mean, I think we've got a lot of disparities in between our majority culture and outcomes and our minority populations and ethnic cultures, and we need to take addressing those seriously. My question, Ms. Wilcox, or to you or to the author, is we have a number of different agencies stepping up to this important work, and my concern is about how do we get them all working together? Because we have assigned the responsibility for dealing with health outcome disparities to the Department of Health, and they have staffing and programs related to that. We also have the councils, like the Councils on Black and African American Minnesotans. We have the Council on Asian and Pacific Islanders. We have a variety of culturally and ethnically specific groups that are charged in state statute with addressing this, some of which have really stepped up on the areas that overlap services of the Department of Human Services. And so when I look at the membership and the responsibilities, I don't see that integration of efforts, and I'm wondering if that's something that we might be able I'm not sure if the intent is really to just advise the Department of Human Services on how their policies impact that, but it's written with a much broader agenda. And so I'm just trying to understand if it's to address beyond programs of the Department of Human Services, then I think we really do need to look at how do we collaborate and coordinate rather than create competing efforts and maybe some duplication of efforts. And so I'm just trying to get a better understanding of the vision, and if you could help me with that, that would be great.
Ms. Wilcoxon.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative
Loeffler.
Thank you. I would like to clarify that this creation of this committee, of this advisory council, is a reaction to this definite, defined group that was meeting at the invitation of the Department of Human Services. At the table during those meetings, the councils of color, the ombudsperson for families, and a variety of other entities, including advocacy organizations, did gather to provide feedback and input. It was not our intent to make it broad-based to replace the current existing work that the councils provide, as well as other state entities. We are limited to the Department of Human Services, and of course, partnership and collaborative efforts are some things that we have been doing for this past 4 years. So that would continue.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Wilcox. I mean, that sounds like the vision I had. I just wasn't sure if the language always reflected it, because it's pretty broad, and as you go to the Government Operations Committee, maybe you want to just put in a few places. It's to advise the Commissioner on Health and Human Services policies under that agency, and you might also want to put some in, consider in the membership, saying that you would seek cross-membership from some of those initiatives potentially, or you know, I this is an area I still have much to learn on. So, but I expected that that was your intent, but I just was a little confused, and I don't want to take away from the enthusiasm and dedication that the councils of color and the councils and others have put into their initiatives that also address these same sort of issues.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I have four members on the list. I just want to remind people, I don't want to cut anybody off, but if you don't want to come back this evening, we need to kind of get through with a little bit of, you know, a little movement here. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just Representative Moran, what's the fiscal note on this?
Representative Moran.
That was the A1 amendment. There is no fiscal.
There is no. That's what I thought. So I just want to clarify that. The other thing I just say, you know, government programs have been trying to address some of these disparities for a long time, and in my opinion, they haven't done a very good job. And I don't know if one more council is going to help. In my opinion, a couple of things would help greatly. One is we need to take a look at our welfare system and how it undermines the traditional family among our minorities. I mean, prior to the Great Society programs of the 60s, the out-of-wedlock birth for black Americans was under 20%. Today in our inner city, it's over 80%. And I think one of the primary drivers of that is the way the government reimburses for welfare programs. And I won't get into the details on it today. So what we need to do is reform welfare so it reinforces traditional marriage and that men begin to accept the responsibility for the children that they help produce. And today, it seems like men can get away almost scot-free in some cases, and the government picks up the tab, and that needs to stop. The second thing I would add is that we need to go back in this country to the teaching of God-given rights, that we're equal before the Creator as human beings, and that we have the same rights from a God-given standpoint, and that's exactly what our preamble of the Constitution of Minnesota says. It says, we the people of the state of Minnesota, grateful to God for our civil and religious liberties. And 49 out of 50 states, including our Declaration of Independence, tells us that we need to look at each other through that prism. And it creates a change in your thinking. And that's one of the reasons I spent 13 years in jail ministries, mostly with minorities, to try to help them, because I believed that they were created in the image of God and that they had the same rights and liberties I did, and to point them in that direction. And I don't see how an additional council is going to solve problems when other councils in the past haven't solved that.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question to clarify, because Representative Loeffler said this applied to the Department of Health and Human Services. I thought it just applied to Human Services. Am I incorrect on that?
You're correct on that, Representative Loeffler.
Human Services. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative and the testifier. I served on state government finance my first 2 years here, and I remember that we had councils. We had the Council on Black Minnesotans, Council on Chicano Latino Affairs, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and the Council on Indian Affairs. And their budgets are, the Council on Black Minnesota is $584,000, $550,000 on the Chicano Asian. The point is, I'm just curious what the difference is. What do they do versus what do you want to do, and are you planning to work together? Maybe that was a little bit of Representative Loeffler's question, but I'm trying to see the differences here. What's the difference between those agencies and what you're trying to do?
Ms. Wilcoxon, do you want
to? Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. I think that, as Representative Loeffler mentioned, I did the language that we presented here is broader than what we had initially intended, and that we are going to take an advisement, make sure that we define it, that it refers to the Department of Human Services, that we'll be working with the Commissioner of Human Services, and the membership of this council will include the councils of color as the current committee meetings do include these members as well as the ombudsperson for families. So in addition to this, there is a variety of other entities, both advocacy organizations, community-based nonprofit organizations, as well as some foundations. So there is a pretty cross-cutting sectors as well as cultures.
Madam Chair.
Representative, who's speaking? Oh, Representative Moran, sorry. I was looking over here.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would like to say that, government has not done a good job, and we can say in a large way that, the programs, the services, and the waste system is currently positioned has not done a good job of supporting communities of color, and others do believe that when decisions are made, it is not always been inclusive of including or engaging those populations on which you are making decisions for and about. And, the Council of Color has a huge mandate, to look at disparities and convene communities of color that they represent and to connect to the legislature and bring those recommendations and advise and update not only the legislature but the governor. This committee here would be also members of, it could be, members from the councils and other entities, but hopefully it would be others who have expertise in maybe out-of-home placement, in the foster care system, MPHIP, those who have been impacted by those systems who can come and say, in my community, currently the programs that you have set up is not supporting the community that I live in. And based on my experience, and based on the experience that I represent for my community, why don't I suggest that it is done this way to create better outcomes? Because I think at the end of the day, what we want to do is begin to look at the strengths of families and communities and allow those entities to be a part of that conversation about how the system and program services can better serve them. And they come with a wealth of information, a wealth of knowledge. And so they are able to be at a table with the commissioner who's making those decisions and help guide and direct that commissioner of the Department of Human Services to create better outcomes for them, their families, and their community, and our children. Because it's really important that today, going forward, that we are in a position of creating better outcomes for all our families. And when we don't do it, it's shameful. It is shameful that the disparities are where they are in Minnesota with all the greatness that we give, that we can look at other communities and say that they're not there. So I think it's important that, whether it's the Council of Color, whether it is the Omnibus, whether it is this committee, we need many people coming to the table to make decisions about their lives and how their lives can be improved and where they can impact policies and decisions.
Thank you, Representative Moran. I have one more member on the list, and that's Representative Allen, and then we're going to vote on this bill. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is, I haven't seen this done, this really done on this large of a scale attempted, and I think it's, we have, I know there's a history of appointing or forming, creating, whatever, authorizing separate councils for different minority groups, but this is the first time I've seen where there's a council form with all cultural and ethnic communities, and it, first I'll back up. If you look at the department, the agencies that serve minority communities, there are community people of color underrepresented in those positions. I mean that formulate policy, that decide how that services are going to be implemented, design models. And so we have these separate councils, and then we say that we're going to consult with them, that they're going to advise us, but most of the time they're not given any authority. They're usually given a position maybe in the department, but they're underfunded, and usually you have individuals in there who maybe don't have the background or the skills or the education to really be effective, and they're not given the support. And so having, you know, just the act of consulting is something that, if you think about, like, Indian tribes, because Indian tribes are the only minority in this country that have a political status. And so you have executive orders that require every single federal agency to consult with tribes on matters that may affect tribes. But we don't do that at the state level. I mean, you struggle even to get states to do that with tribes, let alone with other minority communities that don't have the political status. And so I would say if you put us all in the same room, that maybe you'll listen to us. And then also it is about the fact that we have so many different communities, and I like to borrow that saying that we are more alike than we are different, and that applies to all of us here. But there are some really when you oppress and you have minority communities that are separate, have conflicts. Basically, and those conflicts usually arise because they're competing over scarce resources, and so if we could work together so that we're respectful of each other, and then come up with models that will, because many of the models will fit for, we all live, the minority people live in poverty, the educational disparity, many similarities, but there are unique cultural differences, and I think this would, you know, we would be respectful of that, but I think it would be very powerful in a different way of consulting with minority groups. So thank you, Representative Moran, for bringing this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Allen. So Representative Moran is going to renew her motion that House File 310, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed, and we are adjourned.